Hello, my name's Peter Krekel, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for the second case of our three-part CMEO briefcase series entitled Informed Treatment Decisions for Pain Management, Changing Habits and Improving Outcomes. We hope that you'll join us for the entire series of these cases. Case-based learning is a great way to illustrate not only the challenging patients you'll see, but also a great way to share experiences and strategies for overcoming those challenges. As you know, I teach at St. Francis University, and my students will tell you I am a storyteller, and I think it really does drive home the knowledge that we're trying to impart. So this CMEO briefcase is entitled Partnering with Patients, Counseling Patients About Non-Opioid Pain Options. I'm Peter Krekel, and I'm an adjunct assistant professor of pharmacology at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. There I teach pharmacology to the physician assistant class, that fifth-year didactic class, and I also work as a pharmacy manager at Thompson Pharmacy in Altoona, Pennsylvania, a small little community pharmacy. I'm joined today by Vincent Capone. Vince is an associate medical director and physician assistant at the Empower 3 Center for Health. He's also a trauma physician assistant at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, where he does trauma and emergency medicine here in Altoona. So I'd like to welcome one of my favorite PAs, Vince Capone.
Thank you, Pete.
Our first learning objective for this case is to apply evidence and guideline recommendations supporting non-opioid management to treatment decision making. Our second learning objective is to educate our patients about pain and non-opioid pain management to optimize safe and effective multimodal treatment plans. It's not going to be a one-size-fits-all when it comes to pain management for our patients. So let's crack open our first case and take a look. James, he's a 52-year-old Caucasian male with severe knee osteoarthritis related to a biking injury that he had in his 20s. So this was about 30 years ago. It's an old injury. And over the years, it's really slowed James down. It's really limited his function as well as his mobility. So the orthopedic surgeon sends over an e-prescription for opioids, like we have to in Pennsylvania, just to hold him over until his knee replacement, which has been postponed indefinitely due to that COVID-19 epidemic that seems to have brought even medical care to a standstill. So James calls his pharmacy to discuss his concern about indefinitely taking opioids. Even though he's got all this pain, he's still a little bit concerned about his opioids. So you want to set some time aside to have a conversation with him is how can we make him more comfortable and address James' concern about long-term opioid use? So as you begin to think ahead about your call with James, how are you going to approach it? What do you think the best approach is going to be, Vince?
Well, I like this case because it's not an uncommon type of patient to encounter. All of the options you gave, I think, have some validity in them. So there, I think, lots of initial ways to think about a patient like James. I think in the scenario, we talk about how he had this biking accident. So we can make an assumption that he's an active guy. He's now 52, and that to differentiate between pain and function, right? And maybe take James' lead to see when he's really kind of discussing the things that are bothering him, the pain needs to be addressed, but is he also talking about frustrations with his decline in functioning and staying active? And that could be a great jumping off point to talk about non-opioid approaches to pain, both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic.
I agree entirely. I think what we want to do is always, you know, function is what is really critical. And I think you're pretty good at it, as we all are, is telling our patients that you might not be pain-free, but we certainly want to improve your mobility as well as your functionality.
Well, excellent point. Talking about goals of whatever the pain management approach is important, and it can be sometimes an unsaid expectation or maybe even unexamined expectation of the patient that the goal is complete freedom from pain. And that may not be possible. So to put that on the table and talk about it as early in the process as possible.
So do you think James' concern about opioids is reasonable, knowing that 1 in 16 surgical patients prescribed opioids becomes a long-time user? Do you share his concern?
Absolutely. And the fact that he's voicing concern, I think, is lends itself to being a patient that is kind of thoughtful about how he wants to approach this. And that's a great sign. That's a sign that this is someone that wants to have a conversation about it.
And I think a lot of times too, Vince, sometimes we just set aside acetaminophen and ibuprofen because they're over-the-counter drugs. And I don't think our patients really have a great appreciation for how effective they are in handling those patients' pain. As with most things in life, there's lots of options for pain management well beyond opioids and medication in general. And, you know, in the early 1990s, before we had oxycodone flying off of the pharmacy shelves, we saw a lot more physical therapy. People were even exploring acupuncture, massage therapy, and things like that. Can you share some other ways to approach pain that you might even want to discuss with James as well?
I think physical therapy, particularly for orthopedic concerns, is a great approach. And the earlier in the process, the better. Sometimes PT is thought of as of a post-surgical rehab, but it doesn't have to be that. Sometimes how I frame it for patients that while PT does not help everybody, right? Unlike any medication I can prescribe, there's no side effects from PT. Right. And if we're looking at it just from a safety standpoint, that the worst outcome is the patient doesn't have improvement. I think it's an approach that patients are often amenable to.
Well, I certainly agree with that. And I think that we always have to be looking at these different ways, these different modes of action to handle our patient's pain. So acetaminophen and nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, they're available over the counter. And I think some people just look at it as like, well, it's just Advil or it's just Tylenol. And I think multimodal analgesia, especially with those two, can have a lot of great benefits to our patients. MMA can mitigate the risk profile of each medication. You know, we're using smaller doses. Instead of using 800 milligrams of ibuprofen, 200 or 400 might be enough. Instead of using the 4 grams or the 3,000 milligrams of acetaminophen, maybe we can back down the dose of that and cause potentially less liver problems. So I always say when we combine acetaminophen with ibuprofen together, you're getting 2 plus 2 equaling 6. So those two drugs, even though they are available over the counter, combined, we do see some pretty good outcomes with those medications.
And even in acute settings, I've seen a trend toward using IV Tylenol post-surgically. We commonly use things like IV or IM ketorolac or other NSAIDs to give patients significant relief, and to consider things like muscle relaxants of the appropriate type in conjunction with these other medicines. So there are definitely options aside from opioids, and it's not always an either or, right? These things can be used together synergistically, often to significant effect.
Yeah, I think it's an amazing combination. And this slide that talks about the opioid, non-opioid pain relief and post-op pain, you saw that in class when I taught you and your class. You see it at the clinic all the time. I always have a copy of this study that Dr. Teeter did. It was a retrospective study, but Dr. Teeter put this together, a need-to-treat study. I find it fascinating that when you use oxycodone 15, it takes 4.5 patients is a need to treat for one person to get 50% pain relief. So you treat almost 5 people with oxycodone 15 milligrams 4.5 need to be treated for one person to have that kind of relief. You go to the other side of the scale and you take ibuprofen, 200 milligrams. 200 milligrams of ibuprofen, most of us would think is a subtherapeutic dose. And then the acetaminophen, 500 milligrams, one extra strength Tylenol. Most of us would think that's a subtherapeutic dose. Combine them together and the need to treat was only 1.5. You are essentially saying that your 200 milligrams of ibuprofen and your extra strength acetaminophen is three times more potent than oxycodone 15. And we've shared that a lot with patients at our clinic. That is a study, and it was actually done by the National Safety Council, the same people that certify the safety of your car seats. They're the ones that came out with that study. And I implore everyone listening to this discussion, look that up and share that with your patients.
I think interestingly too, in a post-operative sense, there was a study that I often reflect on that if habituation aside, if you give a patient a script post-surgically when they go home for 90 tablets of oxycodone, or you give them 30, or you give them 15, they tend to use 70% of that script. And that's independent of the type of surgery that they've had. I think that's very interesting. So to consider quantity and what the goals are very important.
Oh, absolutely. So you and I both agree. We really appreciate how potent ibuprofen is over the counter, as well as acetaminophen. Vince, are there any patients that you are a little bit more cautious with when it comes to recommending non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, whether it's your over-the-counter ibuprofen or whether it's what we have in the back, be it meloxicam, paroxicam, celecoxib, any of those NSAIDs that we use a fair amount? Any of those make you put your ears up and take a closer look at the patient?
As you know, there's no medication without potential side effects. And we shouldn't view NSAIDs as a completely safe alternative to opioids, because they do have risks. And there are patient types that you need to be concerned with and how you use NSAIDs. Those include patients that are over 65. Those include patients with a history of GI issues like bleeding ulcers, patients with cardiovascular disease. Long-term use of NSAIDs can affect outcomes with cardiovascular disease. These are cleared by the kidney, so you have to be mindful of the patient's renal status. So there are lots of things to consider with NSAIDs, and like any medicine, you have to think about the potential risks for that patient versus the potential benefits, and consider that before prescribing them.
So Vince, when you're prescribing these NSAIDs, whether you're prescribing them or recommending them, there are some GI protective strategies that we can employ too. And a lot of times at the clinic, you know, I'll raise it to you, or even if I'm practicing over at the store, there are some things that we can look at. I think proton pump inhibitors are by far and away the most common and probably the most effective way to help protect our patients' stomachs that are taking these NSAIDs, because, you know, there's different ways that the NSAIDs can affect our patients. First of all, one of them is called ion trapping. Another one is they can cause direct irritation to the GI mucosa. And also, they decrease your body's ability to clot. So if they do develop an ulcer in the stomach, they're really going to bleed, because we're kind of blocking the clotting mechanism. And also, we have those prostaglandins in our stomach that are protective. They call them mucoprotective. And so there's different ways that maybe we can attack this problem of the NSAID-induced gastropathy. So proton pump inhibitors shut down acid production. They really work well, and that's probably your most effective. Misoprostol, we don't see it used a whole lot. There's a product called Arthrotec, which was diclofenac combined with misoprostol. But the misoprostol has such side effects, especially diarrhea. And of course, it should never, ever be given to a pregnant lady. Histamine 2 receptor antagonists. Wow. We all are very aware that Zantac has been recalled, as well as all of the generic ranitidines, and we're having a lot of trouble getting famotidine. So I would say what I'm seeing here for GI protective strategies, probably the best approach that you and I can use is to recommend any of those drugs, the PPIs, like omeprazole, pantoprazole, esomeprazole. Any of those mucoprotective strategies would probably be the best. They're all available and they're all cheap.
Well, I don't think they're a silver bullet by any means for these kind of monoarthropic conditions like James has described. I've had some luck with Voltaren or diclofenac gel. So that, you know, kind of bypass the GI tract. So, you know, there are options out there. And again, I think it comes down to discussing all these risks versus the benefits for that particular patient.
So let's get back to James. I think James has asked us a bunch of really thoughtful questions, and he seems kind of comfortable with our discussion, you know, showing him that evidence from Dr. Teeter's study, that need to treat study that utilized 500 milligrams of acetaminophen and 200 milligrams of ibuprofen. So after my thorough discussion with James about ibuprofen and acetaminophen, James looks at me and says, I've got another concern and I have another question. I've been seeing all over the TV and the radio that ibuprofen might decrease your body's response to the COVID-19 virus. So Vince, what are we going to share with our patients when they ask us questions about ibuprofen and COVID-19?
My thoughts are there were kind of conflicting conclusions from the World Health Organization. I think we're right now at a place where we just don't know. So while we should talk about those things with the patient, right, we also have to take care of the patient in front of us and do that sometimes imprecise calculation of risk versus benefit, and focus on the patient understanding those risks and having a conversation if they want to proceed. Thus far, I have not stopped prescribing NSAIDs since the COVID-19 pandemic, but it's definitely something to think about and to pay attention to all the new data and understand that it's going to shift.
Oh, I agree entirely. And I think, you know, every time we prescribe an NSAID at the clinic when I'm there, we're always looking at, is this patient a cardiac patient? If they're a cardiac patient, maybe naproxen is a safer cardiac choice. But some of our providers will even say there's no such thing as a good NSAID for a cardiovascular patient. Some of the literature says that until the creatinine clearance falls under 30, I think we are very, very cautious with any of our kidney function patients to avoid NSAID prescribing. So who is most likely to get the sickest from this COVID-19? Probably our older patients, those at risk for nephropathy, those at risk for cardiovascular complications. Those people shouldn't really be taking ibuprofen anyhow, and acetaminophen might be the very best choice for them, whether or not we're in the middle of a COVID-19. So Vince, this has been a great discussion. Let's summarize with our SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And that is what we hope our audience will take away from this discussion and apply it to those patients that are in their practice. Partner with patients to educate them about pain and pain management. We don't want to lower their desire to have good pain management, but we have to educate them and show them that we want to increase their mobility and increase functionality and not necessarily make them pain-free. We want to use multimodal analgesia strategies to improve pain management and mitigate the risk. We also got to consider those risk factors when we're prescribing those NSAIDs, things like how are our patient's kidneys doing? How's our patient's heart doing? How's our patient's gastrointestinal tract doing? And come up with these types of strategies to minimize all of those adverse effects. Well, thanks, Vince, and thanks to our audience for joining us today for case 2 of our 3-part CMEO briefcase series. We hope you'll check out cases 1 and 3 that are available at CME Outfitters using this link below. And also, please check out the Opioid Education Hub, where you'll find a broad range of educational activities and resources for healthcare providers and the patients. we hope we've given you something to think about and some ideas that you'll be able to integrate into your practice using these strategies for partnering with your patients to educate them about non-opioid treatment options in your clinical practice. Thank you so much for joining us.